another episode of Anarcho Book Club. So today we begin a journey, and not to make it sound too dramatic, but it is a journey through an entire book in detail. It's the book, and I mentioned this last week, but it is the book The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. And if you've been visiting, if you've recently visited the website, anarchobook.club, you may have noticed a new section on the site that I've created specifically for this book. I want to emphasize that's how important this book is, I think, to the development of the anarchist framework, to the development of an understanding of the human mind, the human psyche, going back all the way to prehistoric time. And I just wanted to start this first section of this discussion out by kind of giving you my background and why I want to cover this book. So years ago, of course, as any American teen does, I went to a public high school, or as most American teens do. In my sophomore year, I was just bored out of my mind, and eventually I got my parents to pull me out of high school and homeschool me, though they were very resistant, but I did eventually get them to do that. And now they both worked, so homeschooling was a little bit more, it was something that I sort of chose for myself a little bit. I chose kind of what I studied. Now my dad, he gave me a framework to study with, and he tested me, and eventually, and then I took the state tests and the national tests to make sure that I'm actually learning things. But a lot of it was left up to me. But one of the books, one of the pinnacle books that he had me study, it was actually I think it's like 14 volume set, was Will Durant's History of Civilization. This is a massive, massive work. I mean, we're talking very small print, 1400 page book, and there's about 14 of them. And I went through, and basically he had me, in order to learn, he kind of found out early on that the traditional way of learning was not my best method. And in order to learn this stuff, he just basically bought me a whole bunch of notebooks and had me go through and read each chapter of every book in that series and outline each chapter. After I was done reading, I would outline it. I would kind of do it from memory, and then he would go over it whenever he got home from work. Now, that was fun. I know that doesn't sound like fun, but for me, that was a lot of fun because it was something that I could do to actually learn something about history. But, and how that relates to this book that we're going to be going through is in that, I can't remember which one of those books, or even maybe it wasn't even in those books, at one point I discovered The Hero with a Thousand Faces during my study of Will Durant's books. And I picked it up at it was a local bookshop. I can't remember which one it was, but I went and I found it, and by that point I was working, so I had some money, and I went and picked up a copy of it. A copy that I still have, but it's worn, so I actually have a different copy that I picked up whenever I was in college. And so Will Durant covered the history of things, and all the way to prehistoric history. And if you work your way through all 14 volumes of his History of Civilization, you will find that this book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, really boils all that down into one sort of seminal work. It boils all the mythology down and all the philosophy down and all the psychology behind it all, behind all of the history, into this one work. Of course, you don't get all the details, but that's neither here nor there, because that's not what we're after. We're not after all of the small details of history. But I bring those two together here because between the two, I started to develop a love for mythology, a love for philosophy, and a love for the study of human psychology. And this book has really helped me develop. It's actually one of the books that I could even sit here and claim really steered me towards the philosophies of the anarchist. Not because Joseph Campbell is an anarchist, because he's not, I don't think. In fact, I'm sure he's not. But because to understand the true mythology behind the mind of every human, to understand the unity of mythology. To understand the human psyche in this way, it really helps you understand why some people tend towards anarchy and some people tend towards something like tyranny or something like fascism. It really helps a person understand with keen insight how someone could turn towards something like fascism, or how someone could turn towards something like some sort of tyranny, how someone could turn towards like and support socially, like in a society, on a societal level, support someone like Lenin, who rung in the tyrannous state of the Soviet Union. It was not the anarchist communist paradise that so many dreamed of, but rather something like a top-down tyrannous state, something that I think even Hitler would have been impressed by, and probably was. So as we begin this journey, I want to keep all of this in mind, that the real, well, at least what I drew from this book the first few times that I read it, was the kind of the workings behind the minds of each individual, be they some rich billionaire who lives up on a hill somewhere out away from the world, or be they a common person who lives on the streets. We all have some sort of a unity of psyche in the end. And whenever you look at that rich billionaire and you call him evil, realize at that moment you are creating your own mythology. That is the demon, that is the dragon on the hill, that is the dragon under the mountain, as it were. That is the great antagonist. And you paint yourself into that mythology as, or you write yourself, I should say, into that mythology as the hero of the story, or perhaps a supporting character in the story for the hero. And then you pick out your heroes. And those heroes, though flawed they are, they develop into something that, well, they develop into a picture of something kind of like perfection. You have Theseus from Greek mythology, or from, maybe some would call it Greek history. He's painted as this hero, this perfect picture, who slays the evil offspring of the queen. Or you have the picture of a Hercules, who does something very similar. He's fighting the fight against evil. And these are the images, and it's all unified in this idea. This is mythology. So whenever someone says, ah, that's a myth, you say, well, this is true. And they say, no, that's a myth. Perhaps it is. Perhaps it is a myth. But that doesn't make it untrue either. And that's one of the things I want to drive home, is because in my experience, the creation of myth is not the spinning of lies. It's not the weaving of untruths into the narrative. No, the creation of myth is a perceptual thing. It is a way for your mind to understand a situation and make a choice that is, in your own eyes, what is best. And that's what I want to study. That's why I want to study this book in depth. Because if, as an anarchist, you want to see a future society where there is something that looks like human freedom, if you want a society that is free of whatever you may call tyranny, if you want to free a society from the dragon that comes down off of his mountain and eats up the children and the innocents, if you want a society free of that dragon, free of the demons, who we also call politicians, then you have to understand. You have to understand the mythology behind what you want. You have to understand the philosophies. And in the end, the thing that will change society, the thing that will change the world, it all starts in your life, in your home, in your community. And the only thing, as I've said many times before, the only thing that you can change is yourself. And in doing so, you can change those around you, or at least you can help to shape their perceptions, help to generate their mythologies, their personal mythologies, and in effect change the world, possibly, if there's enough people doing it all at once. So as we dive into this, I just want you to keep all of that in mind. We'll see where we go from there. So we'll start with the prologue. Today we're just going to cover the prologue, which, if you haven't noticed, you may have noticed if you visit the website at all, I have it up on the website, the prologue. I wrote it all out by hand, because I wanted to get rid of... So I downloaded the EPUB version of it. There's a free version on archive.org that I downloaded and threw up on my website. And it is something like 150 megabytes. And that's because of all the images and all the little extras that are included. So I started to... But here's the other problem. It's not formatted very well. So I started to cut out all the bits and take out all the images and all of that. And it was going to take me so long just to edit out the image tags so that you don't have ugly image tags all over the place that I decided I'm just going to see how long it takes me to just type it out from the book that I have in an editor. And it took me about, it took me a couple of hours. And I figured, you know, that's actually going to be a little bit faster than trying to edit that massive EPUB file. So that's what I did. And it gave me the ability to throw it up on the site so you can just read it straight from the website. It's under Docs, the new tag at the top, Docs. And then you've got Joseph Campbell Prologue. That's all I've got up there now because I stopped. After I got this typed up, I went ahead and started making my notes for this episode today. So I'm going to be going straight from the book, but you can follow along on the website if you'd like. So the prologue. The prologue is the monomyth. And that is the myth that transcends culture. The myth that you find throughout the world. And let me just get to the table of contents here, because the heading titles are a great way to look at it. And the first section of this, of the prologue, is myth and dream. And then you have tragedy and comedy, the hero and the god, and the world navel. And these things, these four sections, at least in Campbell's mind, sum up the monomyth. The world myth, the unifying myth in all human societies and all human cultures. And after, I mean, reading this book and then reading through The History of Civilization by Will Durant, I think it, well, there's a reason why Joseph Campbell is so respected throughout the world, because I think he's found something here that is useful. So for the study of mythology, that is. So we'll start with myth and dream. And he goes through, and you'll see, I did notice, at least in the prologue, something I had not noticed before. He kind of focuses on the Far East myths and the Greek myths. He doesn't touch on a lot of the other myths throughout the world, at least in the prologue. But I think that's because those are the most relatable at the time, especially at the time of writing this book. There was a pretty strong surge in... the United States or American interests in Chinese mythology and Chinese culture, for that matter. And, oh, and I should tell you, the book was, at least the version I'm using, it was written and published in 1968, or I'm sorry, it was published in 1968. The original edition of this book was 1949. So, this was a book written long ago, but it feels almost as if it was just written maybe just a few years ago, the way he talks about things. So he goes through in Myth and Dream, and he compares, he draws a lot on Freud, Jung's, their focus on dream interpretation and the myths behind those dreams, the self-creating myth within the minds of each person. And he goes through and he actually covers a few individual accounts sent into newspapers or sent in or recorded by psychologists. And it's this myth of he talks about the myth of Oedipus or Oedipus Rex, that is, and the Oedipus complex that Freud discusses and Jung expands upon, and how that is throughout the whole world a sort of a focus, which is part of the reason, and that's the other thing, that's part of the reason why Jung and Freud were able to study it so in-depth and so extensively, is because it's something you can see, and Jung especially drew upon mythology for his studies. Freud, I'm not so sure, I mean, I think he does, because I've studied some of Freud, but I'm by no means an expert on Freud, but Jung especially I know because I've studied a lot of Jung because I studied linguistics and mythology at university. So I studied a lot of Jung, and he really draws on mythology. A lot of his psychological analysis, or psychoanalysis, that is, was focused on what he knew of myth and fairy tales, and you may be hearing this and think, oh, that's odd, right? That's he's using fairy tales, children's stories, as it were, to help treat patients with whatever kind of mental illness they may have. But in fact, he has justifications for it. Justifications including, well, the very thing that we were just talking about. The fact that these myths are, they are omnipresent, as it were, in all of society. These are things that preoccupy the minds of so many people, whether they know it or not. So the myth of, or the story of Oedipus Rex, where he kills his father and marries his mother, this, although to our modern mind this may seem odd, there are underlying urges. Well, that may not be the right term. There are underlying attachments in the mind of any young man who was brought up and had a mother. They will run to their mother for help whenever they're young. Sometimes whenever they're not young, a matter of fact. They always run to the mother, and he talks about this, how they run to their mother even, what was it? I think it was an Australian mythology of the snake that wants the foreskin of the young man, or of the young child. And sometimes they would bring the child, the men of the tribe would bring the child out and say, we must cut your foreskin off, the snake can smell it. The great snake, I believe, can smell your foreskin and he wants it. And we've got to cut it off. And that's his journey into manhood. That is his trial. That is the way he is brought up into manhood. And Campbell goes through and discusses that mythology and all the others. There's quite a few others concerning the same thing. So the young child, sometimes, he said, you'll notice that the child will almost always, actually, not just sometimes, but always run back to his mother for safety. And you think, the mother is the protector. She's the great protector in pre-modern societies. And the men are seen as some sort of outside threat. And that's not too far from what I see today. I have a friend who is a therapist for children, young boys mostly. And almost universally, she still sees this in them. The same thing, where the father or the man is the threat, though he is still part of the family. And though the son, 9 times out of 10, will still say that he loves his father, and he trusts his father, but whenever it comes right down to it, he trusts his mother more whenever he's that young. And some of these young men will never grow out of that. They will never move on to being their own person. They will always be stuck to their mother's hip. They will always be, what's the old saying? They will always be on the apron string of their mother. And it's not necessarily a sexual thing, as Campbell says. It's not always something sexual, but the whole idea of Oedipus is that the young man is always drawn towards that which first protected him, that which gave him birth, that which gave him food, that which made him feel safe. The first thing that made him feel safe, that is what the young man is drawn toward. And he doesn't get into the female side of this relationship, but he mainly stays on the mythology route. And he goes through in this first section of the prologue and discusses all of these. The snake, the great father snake. Sorry, I said the great snake. It was the great father snake smells your foreskin. He is calling for it. That's the quote of the book. But he goes through these, and it's all sort of dreamlike. These the storytelling behind these myths, it's very dreamlike. And he goes through the dreams of individuals who have had dreams like this, which is more than likely where these myths came from. And even today you'll see that people have dreams of something horrible that's going to happen, and then something horrible happens, and they'll claim the same thing. I had a dream about this, and this is what happened. And people will crowd around this, and though many will say that they're skeptics of this idea that you can dream something that comes, they will still crowd around, and they will pay it lip service. They will pay it respect. They will respect the person for their views of, well, at least publicly, because it's acceptable to do so. And there's something there as well. There's something in that. If you, well, just think of it this way. Years ago, or not years ago, but a few years ago, I worked as a security officer at a public library, of all things. And there was one section of the library that was rather dark and quiet. See, modern libraries, at least in my area, they're not very quiet anymore. And there aren't very many books. But there is one section, the historical section, where they have actual library attendants that will help you find historical facts for local purposes. But I mention that because it is the one quiet section, and it is rather dark back there as well. Sure, there are lights, but something seems to suck the light out of the air, if you understand. And I would make my rounds, and I'd always go through there and chat with the... there was a historian on staff as well. And we'd chat, and one day, I was walking through, making my rounds, checking the doors, making sure no one left anything unlocked, and one of the historians, he was a younger man, maybe in his mid-30s or so, maybe late-30s. He said, "Hey, Harag, come here." Okay, so I walked over there. I didn't have much to do. The doors were probably locked anyway. I walk over. I'm like, "What's up?" He said, "Look at this." And he shows me a picture on his phone of a, it looks like a flash of light behind him. Well, it's a picture of him. There's like this little flash of light behind him. And he begins telling me a story about how there's a ghost in this picture and how he captured, or his, I think it was his partner, possibly, took this picture and there was a ghost behind him. And of course, I'm instantly, okay, that's, I'm very skeptical of this. But he continues to tell me, and if he sees in my face that I'm skeptical, I don't say anything because, you know, it's, to see a ghost in, is something that is, maybe it's something to be ridiculed privately, but you won't openly ridicule someone for it. And I just smile and, oh, okay, yeah, okay, there's a ghost. And, but he could tell that I was skeptical. He goes, no. And he tells me this story about the ghost. And he comes up with this story on the spot. Perhaps it's something that was brewing in the back of his mind all along. But he tells me this story of the ghost. And how it's appeared in many of his pictures, and it seems to follow him around. And he comes up with reasons why it might be there. And he comes up with all of these theories about the ghost that was in his picture. And to my mind, it was an anomaly, a flash of light or something. But he's absolutely convinced that it is a ghost. This is his mythology. There's a ghost following him. He lives his own stories. And that's what we go through in Myth and Dream. What we realize, hopefully, is that you begin to see that you live your own story, and now Campbell is showing us the different types of stories that can occur. In the next section, section two, we move out of the dream world and the myth and dream world, but we stay sort of in that world, in the world of dreams, with tragedy and comedy, because things happen, right? And just like my friend in the historical section of the library, things happen to him. Bad things. Good things. But things happen to him, and he told himself the story of those things. And every time you see anything, let's take the killing of George Floyd, for instance. Things happen. It's a tragedy. In my mind, anytime anyone dies is a tragedy, regardless of the circumstances. But in the case of George Floyd, there was video of what happened. And I've talked to many different people about it. Some people say, looks like the cop was justified in keeping him down. Oh, no, that was a great and terrible tragedy that he sat on his back like that and eventually the poor man died. And I'm not so much interested in the facts, exactly. And that may sound bad, but let me explain. Whenever I hear the stories from each individual about what they saw in that video footage, or what they've heard come out behind that video footage, or what they have experienced themselves, I realize, and this is something I realized back whenever it was happening, we each have our own mythology based on our own previous experience. Your mythology may be that you saw this and something in the back of your mind informed you that this was a tragedy, that this is a horrible thing that's happened, and something has to be done. Another person may have seen it and said, George Floyd, he was on drugs, see, and, you know, it's his own fault that he died. And that's that person's mythology, see? And maybe in your mind right now, you're sitting here listening to this, and you're thinking, that's just terrible. And it is, I think. That's my mythology telling me that it's just terrible for someone to say, ah, he was on drugs, it's his own damn fault. To me, that's horrible. Because anytime you see something like that, for instance, one of the pinnacle historical events in my life was, and I think for most millennials, the fall of the World Trade Centers. A lot of people saw that and said, ah, we've been attacked, this is horrible. But even as a much younger version of myself, whenever I saw it, my first thought was, it was an almost instantaneous, dreamlike picture within my mind of what must be going through the minds of every person in that building, or those buildings, I should say. My second thought was, well, it was probably similar to that as well, what must be going through the minds of the people rushing to the scene. But eventually I came around to, what must be going through the minds of the people who hijacked the planes and drove them into the two buildings? And see, part of running through these scenarios in your mind is to build a myth in your head. And back then, the myth was, ah, the dragon has come down from the mountain and has attacked. We must go and rise against it and take down the dragon, which at the time we were calling terrorism. That was the dragon. But eventually you grow up and you learn that all these things, all these events, they're just tools. Maybe they're not orchestrated, but they're either allowed to happen, or they are accidentally inspired. I tend to side with the people that say these things are accidentally inspired. But these attacks, something like this happens. These are human beings, you see. Some humans fighting against other humans. And if you see the big picture, you might develop a more complex mythology around the whole thing. And this mythology may not be false. This mythology is simply true to you. The people that boarded the planes, or who hijacked the planes, that is, maybe for them, there was a different mythology. We're attacking those who at a whim, will send a cruise missile to my house and kill my family. And you have to understand and empathize with that. Because think about it like this. The person, maybe one of the people on the plane, had a family. Say it was a family of, let's just for argument's sake, a family of five. And he was off working, or he was off doing something. Maybe he was training to fight against their great dragon, which was the United States, or is. And a cruise missile comes out of nowhere because people are trying to indict a president named Bill Clinton for something or another. And as any good president knows, anytime you're under indictment, you must start a war. Look back through history and that's what happened. Or if you're under suspicion, or if there's some urgent need to distract the people while you do something or you push through some legislation that you need to go through, you always must start a war. And this cruise missile came out of the air, out of the sky, and struck his house and killed his family. Each individual life snuffed out. Maybe he had a wife, and maybe she was cleaning the floors or doing something, you know, I don't know. Every time I've been to the Middle East, it seems like they're always cleaning the floor. The people's houses I go to, they're always cleaning their floors. And I don't know, although I will say, some of the cleanest floors I've ever seen in my life. But, or perhaps they're preparing dinner. The kids are gathered around, helping mother prepare dinner. And then, in a split second, maybe they hear it right before it strikes. That high-pitched whistling right before it strikes. And they all know what that sound is, you see. Because it happens all the time. It has been happening all the time for damn near 30 to 40 years. Probably longer than that, but that's as long as I know it's been happening. That sound. The sound of a drone flying through the air nowadays. But the sound of a cruise missile, it's a familiar sound. It's the sound of the dragon, you see. And they have their own mythology. And the dragon just snuffed out the lives of this man's family. Now, I don't know if this man had three children and a wife, or what have you. I don't know what he had, or what he lost. What I do know is he was fighting the dragon, the evil in the world. And what I also know is the people that died in that building, in those two buildings that fell, the World Trade Centers, they died, and the whole country rallied to fight their own dragon. And now these are two different societies, and they have their own myth of the same dragon, and they're fighting that dragon. And this is the power of myth. Ah, another book by Joseph Campbell. Maybe another one that I would recommend reading. The power of myth. The power of mythology. So then whenever we look back at the George Floyd incident, the power of myth inspires riots, but also the power of myth inspires hatred from the other side. Because they both have dragons, you see. They both have the great evil, the demons that they must fight. And if you can learn to empathize with all sides, or at least understand, yeah, empathize, that's what it means. Understand the feelings of the other side. Then you can put everything into a better perspective and help develop your own mythology around what happens. Because that's all anything really is. It is a personal mythology that we call perspective or worldview. It is a personal mythology, though, behind everything. And I've gone on this single topic for far too long because we're only two sections in and we've only just started tragedy. Now, we've outlined tragedy, but there's also comedy, and there's always this dichotomy of tragedy and comedy, and they sometimes cross over. If you've read Shakespeare or seen a Shakespeare play, you watch one of his comedies, like The Merchant of Venice, and there's some tragedy in there, but it is a comedy because it will have a good ending. But then there's tragedies. I know probably Hamlet is not considered a tragedy in the purest sense, but I would consider Hamlet a tragedy. Because there's so many tragic things. In the end, everyone dies, so maybe it is considered a tragedy. Sorry if I ruined it for you, if you haven't seen Kenneth Branagh's rendition of Hamlet, which I very, very highly recommend. It is a very long film, but it is one of the greatest renditions of Hamlet that I have ever seen in my life. And I recommend it so highly, just so you can understand the depths of tragedy, that maybe that should be your part of your homework. Go watch it. If you have a partner, force them to watch it with you. Or don't. I don't. But he goes through this dichotomy of tragedy and comedy. And it's a short section, but we have these two. It's sort of a bipolar relationship with our own mythologies of... And you can even tell a person's worldview. If they see the world and they see these incidents, these horrible incidents, or these great incidents happening, and if in their mind it is a tragedy, and if you further talk to them about other things that have happened, you may discover that everything they see is a tragedy. And you can start to understand their worldview, their myth, their personal mythology. If it's all a comedy, however, that's also not healthy. Nothing always ends well. It doesn't always end well. Nothing does. But it is a matter of perspective, so perhaps it does end well often, or perhaps it doesn't. But that is a foundation to mythology. Greek myth, modern myth, it's in the Greek plays, you always had that. Modern plays, you have that. The constant deluge of film on screen that we all see. All of these TV shows, all of these movies, they all have this tragedy and comedy dichotomy. It is essential to the human myth. And of course, that's why he covers it. So, and then you have the hero and the god. That is part three of the prologue. The hero and the god is sort of a standard myth. Think of Star Wars. You have the hero and you have the god. You also have the great evil. Luke Skywalker is the hero. And he's fighting against the evil, the dragon, as it were. You might even say he's a freedom fighter, though I don't know. But in fact, Star Wars is a perfect embodiment of this. It encapsulates, and perhaps that's why it was so popular. It encapsulates so much of the essence of myth. It encapsulates all the different aspects of mythology within a three-part film, or three separate films as episodes. I always see the original Star Wars as just a three-part film, though, because it's too long to fit in one film. But it has this comedy and this tragedy, but it also has the hero and the god. Now, who is the god in the situation? Is it the Force? Perhaps. Is it Darth Vader? Perhaps. He's fighting against it. I believe the god is the Force, or the... It's the attainment. And this is a perfect, because... What Campbell goes through is the Buddha and the ascension of, I can't remember his name, the ascension of an individual, we'll just put it that way because I didn't write it down for some reason, the ascension of the individual to becoming the Buddha through his trials. And there's always trials, as you also see in Star Wars. And you ascend to a level, and there will be the gods like Darth Vader and Darth Sidious, There'll be the other gods who help you as well along the way. But some will be working against you and some will be working for you. But in the end, you will ascend to the height of existence, to the height of awareness. And that's what we're all trying to do. At least, if you're listening to this podcast, I hope you're always trying to expand your worldview, expand your horizons, the horizons of your mind. And that's why I wanted to study this book, because it's one of the great books that has expanded my own mind. But he also goes into, so he doesn't just go into the Buddhist myth, but he also goes into the Jewish myths, which I think on a level it is somewhat equal to the Buddhist myth, but it's also a bit weaker, at least. So whenever I was reading through his interpretation of the Jewish myth of Moses on Mount Sinai, I thought his interpretation of it was a bit, well, it seemed like he was looking for another supporting myth to see the unity. There are many more out there that he could have used. He did use the Greek myths as well, so that's something. But in the end of this section, though, he goes through and he lays out the plan for this book. And he says in chapter 1, he's going to cover the call to adventure, or the signs of the vocation of the hero. And that is the call. So in Luke Skywalker's case, he's called to adventure by Obi-Wan Kenobi. And then the refusal of the call. He flees from the call. He doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want anything to do with it. And then supernatural aid. He discovers the Force. He needs the Force to get away from that, I don't know what it was, it's been a long time, but the big Yeti-looking thing that captures him on the snowy planet. And then the crossing of the first threshold. And then we go to the belly of the whale. And in my mind, I see that as Luke Skywalker on the planet with Yoda. Dagobah or something? I can't remember what it's called. But that's where that's the realm of night that he must pass through. There's dangers all over, and he has to expand his mind. He has to learn to use the Force. He has to learn how to exist within the darkest regions of the world, or of the universe, as it were. And he goes through the road of trials. And so this, the road of trials, I see as far as concerning Star Wars, it would be more likely, it's Luke Skywalker's road to, perhaps it's to rescue Princess Leia, which is also the meeting with the goddess, which is number 2 of the second subsection. That's chapter 2. And I don't really know what number 3 for this would be for Star Wars, the woman as the temptress, but perhaps it's his kiss with Leia or something. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly. Atonement with the Father. That is his realization that Darth Vader is his father, and his internal struggle with that. And again, this is another thing that he doesn't cover right here in this part of the book, but the seeing the father as the antagonist in the beginning. This is another Oedipus style issue. So, and then he goes through in, let's see, the third chapter in the discussion will be refusal of the return. And he denies the world and stays away. And maybe that's actually him going to see Yoda. I'm not sure. The magic flight, where he escapes. That maybe is also his time on the snowy planet, where they take down the big walker unit thing. I don't know. I hope you guys have seen Star Wars so you understand what I'm talking about. Because I don't actually remember half of this. And he goes through all of the different stages. But you can kind of think of it as, if you look at Star Wars, they cover most of it, if not all. Although some of them might be kind of a fuzzy realization of this. So, and he goes through all of that. But then we get to the section 4 of the prologue, which is the world navel. And he goes into a myth that I studied, and that is the world tree, Yggdrasil, Scandinavian mythology. This is the Scandinavian mind, Norse mythology, as it were. And this is the hero becomes the world navel. He becomes, so in the Buddhist mythology, the world navel is the place where the Buddha would not move from before he became the Buddha, I guess. I don't know when that transformation exactly occurred. It is that place from which this new knowledge comes from. For Scandinavian or Norse myth, perhaps that is the hanging of the god. That is Odin hanging from the tree for 9 days and receiving the wisdom of the runes, which is just simply the wisdom and the knowledge of the world. It is going through a trial to receive the gift of wisdom, or the gift of knowledge, or the gift that you might need to sustain yourself in your trials against the dragon. In Beowulf, it would be the gift, it would be his trial, his initial trials would be against the beast that was visiting the village and taking away men one at a time. And his struggle against that beast, and his wandering out looking for the beast and the beast's mother in the end. That's the struggle, the great struggle. And that's when he becomes the world naval. He gains the knowledge, and he becomes something like the king, as it were. And of course, Beowulf is a tragedy where he dies at the end at the hand of the dragon, but also dies at the end because of treachery amongst his follower. But he is the center of knowledge at that point, or at least the center of wisdom. He is the great ring giver, the one who gives knowledge, wisdom, and the ability to sustain oneself in this harsh world. The world navel is the hero, but it's not the hero. It is centered around the hero. The hero brings about the world navel, and maybe he is called such, but in the end, it is from where all wisdom and knowledge will spring forth for a society, for a given society. And this chapter, or this section, is also relatively short, but he goes through and he discusses it with the Greek myths, the Divine Comedy by Dante, and he ends it there, discussing the Divine Comedy and its implications on mythology. And that's when, that is the end of the prologue and the beginning of part one, The Adventure of the Hero. In chapter one, it's called Departure, and we won't go into that now. That'll be saved for next week, because I think we have enough to think about. Before editing, I'm already at well over an hour recording this. I don't know what it'll be after I'm done. But the prologue is the introduction to the rest of the book, of course. This is what we can expect from the rest, and a more in-depth study of each of these sections, of each of these individual topics. And starting with the hero myth, of course, because this is the hero with a thousand faces, starting with the ascension of the hero, or the discovery of the hero. But just to kind of look back on what we've talked about so far, all of these things come together, and I hope I've made the impression. I don't know, I've probably repeated myself multiple times in this podcast, but I want to drive home the point that there is the monomyth, which is the title of this prologue. There is the monomyth, and you can see it throughout all of history. You can see it throughout all societies of the world, including remote societies like the Aboriginals in Australia and the Aztecs, who were remote from the rest of the world, from the Greeks, from the Egyptians, from like the Chinese myths and the Indian myths, from the Russian myths, from the Norse myths. Yet they still had the same concepts, because we all create our own myths. Each individual creates their own myth. And within society, within a society, say you're part of a community, you have a collective myth amongst yourselves. And it's because of, like I mentioned earlier, there are socially accepted ways to ridicule another person's mythology. But the times that you don't are the times at which that myth solidifies a bit for the community, for the society, or at least the micro-society that within which you live and exist. And those myths develop, and that's what some people will call the culture war. It's whenever two societies clash in their mythologies. And that's always been the driving force behind every war, be it a culture war where people aren't killing each other, or be it a hot war where people are killing each other, be it the war on terrorism, quote-unquote, or the war against drugs, it states. Or in the world, I guess. No matter what war it is, there's always a warring between different societal myths. And so if you can stop for just a moment, just stop thinking of this concept of the United States as a real thing, because it's not. Or if you're in the UK, stop thinking of your country. Stop thinking of it as a real thing, and think of the societies within your country. Or if you're in Australia, or if you're in wherever you are, it doesn't matter. Stop thinking of this construct that your quote-unquote betters have given you. I am not a United States citizen. Well, I am, officially. But that's not how I see myself. I'm not a citizen of my state, in my mind. I am a member of a particular community. And this is a community I chose. Well, sort of. Maybe I can't even say that. Perhaps I can't say it. Because I don't know if I chose it so much as it chose me. Because I was given books to read, which led my mind down a certain path. And I realized the ideas of anarchy. The concepts. The ideal of anarchy. And my mind began to form mythology around this idea. I began to perceive the myths of the world through that lens. And because of that, I sat down and started recording podcasts, studying the great anarchist, and now studying Joseph Campbell, because I think it's important to understand these things, to understand that your enemy may only be your enemy because you've decided that they are your enemy. You say, you look at the world and you say, we gotta kill the Nazis. So whoever you identify as a Nazi is your enemy. That is the dragon. That is the beast that you must kill, that you must slay. But perhaps you should examine your worldview, and anytime anything ever leads you to something that may seem, well, violence against another human being, anytime you're led down that path, in my opinion, from my point of view and my mythology, I tend to look at that and say, maybe you should stop and think about this for a minute. If you're taking violence to a person, and you're using it against them, and it could cause the end of their story, the end of their life, well, perhaps you should think about it. I'm not going to tell you that you can't do that, but perhaps you should think about it for a minute and really consider the planes that hit the towers, the planes that hit the World Trade Centers, the men on those planes. They decided to take violence to the perceived threat, visit this violence upon the dragon, and hopefully take the dragon down. And why? Maybe it's because this is who they perceived as the one, the dragon, the beast, that came into their homes and took the lives and ended the stories of their own people. But why? Why did those people have to die? Well, perhaps it's because there was a mythology spun about these people that we need to visit violence upon them. And again and again and again and it goes. It's a circular motion. It's a circular theory. All things go in a circular motion. It comes back again. Look at the Norse myth. It starts with the breathing of life into the logs, which become humans, man and woman. And it goes, and it keeps going, until we reach the Ragnarok, which is a full circle. Because it's an arc, a story arc, that comes around and comes back down in fire and torment and war. But then out of that war is birthed a new life, and it begins again. And it continues again until we come back to the dragon that burns the world, to the god Surtur who envelops the world in flame. And it continues, and it goes forever. And this is the circular pattern of mythology. And you can see it in everyday life. The United States launches a new attack against another nation. Just today I woke up and saw the news that Israel has decided to attack Gaza once again. And it's all circular. Now they're visiting death and destruction upon a community that is not theirs, that is not like them. And these communities will be warring until one of them is gone. But then there'll be other communities that will be warring, and it will continue on and on again. But it's all directed by a state, which is why we are anarchists. Because perhaps if a singular state or a singular organization quits trying to force everyone into their own mythology, then perhaps the damages can be mitigated. Perhaps. At least that's my mythology. That's my philosophy. That's my worldview. And this is what I think this book will be launching into. It is to show us the circular nature of the hero story. To show us the circular nature of mythology. So we're going to close there with those thoughts. I hope you enjoyed the prologue. I hope you enjoyed reading it, and I hope you enjoyed my commentary on it. If you did, let me know. Send me some love on LBRY or Odyssey, and it'll help me keep publishing, because apparently the more LBC, I believe is what it's called, that you use when you publish what I'm publishing, which is like a audio video file, the more likely it will be seen by other people. So the more you guys visit my Odyssey channel or LBRY channel, and maybe comment or send me some LBC, some tokens, the more I can publish, or the more I can back my publishes with. Otherwise, we're just going to be throwing it all on the RSS feed, which is fine. This is kind of an experiment, trying to get it out there a little bit more. So, but I hope you enjoyed all of this. If you did, comment on the LBRY video or Odyssey video. I'll put links in the description. Or send me a message on Mastodon. Again, I'll put links in the description where you can send me the message. Or another option is you can send me an email at anarchobookclub@riseup.net. And I'll, of course, put a link in that description as well, and description for that as well. So I hope you enjoyed this. Next week, hopefully. Now, chapter one is a bit longer, so I'm going to try to get through it. If I am unable to get through it, well, no, we'll just see where we go. I'll try to get through it. I'll at least read it. I may not have it up on the website. That's what I was trying to get at. I'm going to try to, though. It just depends on how I can manage my time. So, yeah. So if you don't already have a copy of it, I've got that big EPUB file online that you can download and try to muddle through. Or you can go to any bookstore, any major bookstore at least, and buy a copy of this book. It's pretty popular. It's out there everywhere. So just read through it with us and join the club. Join the Anarcho Book Club. So I hope you guys enjoyed this, and I hope you guys have a great weekend.